Speaking of guitar players, want to walk down memory lane here a little bit. You've worked with two pretty notable guitar players, Kim Thayil and Tom Morello.
Two very unique guitar players, too. And also, you know, in terms of people, it's really unusual that I would end up in band situations with two people who are from, like, the suburban Chicago area that are really unusual guitar players that are college-educated. That are, like, just... that are intellectuals, but passionate. They've got, like, so many things in common. But, and they're completely different than each other.
Absolutely. As players.
As players and as people, it was really... I remember at one point, once I really started to get to know Tom, thinking, God, it's really weird how there are so many similarities. And, you know, you always have to wonder, like, is there some, you know, is there some bigger picture? Is there a reason why I am with someone like that, you know? Because, to be honest, you know, there's a lot of knucklehead guitar players out there, too. And I include myself in that. I'm a super clumsy guitar player that learned how to play guitar based on the fact that I wanted to write songs so I could have a band that had good ones.
Right.
Instead of being in a lot of lousy bands, which is what my, up until Soundgarden, that was my life. And I had, seventh grade was the last year I finished school. So it's been really a fortunate thing for me to be in bands with guitar players who are educated, because, like, especially with Kim, the guy taught me, he was a big influence on me as far as guitar playing goes.
Right.
Because I basically taught myself how to play guitar with him around in the room. And I, you know, he's probably my biggest influence that way. But also just as... being an intelligent, educated person, you couldn't be around someone like him and not become a smarter person or better for it, you know, especially coming from my background, which is I pretty much went at 14 into the blue-collar labor pool.
Have you spoken to Kim at all in recent years?
Yeah, recently.
So things are okay?
Yeah, we've always been good friends. Everyone in the band, we always have gotten along
okay.
Well.
Recently, of course, on YouTube was this big hit clip of Soundgarden with Tad filling in for you and Tom Morello. So you basically have everybody that like you've played with, except for Tad. And what was that like to see that?
I shared the stage with Tad, though.
Okay.
Because we toured together, so...
Now, what was that like for you to see that?
I thought it was really great. I didn't actually see the one with Tom...
Because they did Spoon
Man. But seeing Tad was good. Seeing Tad with those guys was good because the timing was kind of interesting. You know, I've done a couple of interviews recently about the 15-year anniversary, and I'm not really like an anniversary guy.
Yeah,
marking time is meaningless to me. But it now, you know, there's this. It's been 15 years since the passing of Kurt Cobain. And so, you know, why not? When it was 11 years or when it's 26, whatever. So an even number, three groups of five. But we were with the band Tad. Soundgarden and Tad were touring together in Europe, and so we were all together in the dressing room when we found out that Kurt had been found.
Wow.
And this kind of, to see them together now, after doing these interviews, it felt good. It made sense to me, especially, you know, I'm not in Seattle. I don't live there. I'm not around there. And so it kind of felt to me just good and appropriate, you know, and it gave me a warm feeling.
I've heard you say in other interviews that if you were there at that gig, that you would have loved to have jumped on stage, and you even indicated that a Soundgarden reunion isn't out of the question.
Well, I've said it, you know, since we broke up, because I've every interview I've done pretty much since 1998, so that has been part of the subject.
Right.
And it's the same answer always, which is like, you know, I'm someone that is a realist. You never know, you know, what can happen. I mean, I came from this Seattle underground scene, and I just made an album with Timbaland. So what I'm not going to sit here and count out anything.
Right. But I guess what I'm getting at is, so there is no lasting bad blood between anybody.
There's never any bad blood.
Okay.
Between any of us. I think for me, even and also that's the case with Audioslave. I've been on tour with a lot of bands.
Yeah.
I've seen what it looks like when bands and members of those bands don't like each other. I've seen it when they hate each other. I've seen it when two key members of a legendary band are still touring and haven't spoken to each other face to face in over 15 years, and then we'll speak through their tour manager who's sitting between them. So I think of Soundgarden and the Audioslave as being two bands that got along incredibly well in the world of rock bands, and not even that tumultuously, really. The only drama Soundgarden ever had is when we were all drunk at the same time and getting into silly drunken drama that happens, you know, no matter what, that's not real and doesn't matter, which ends up in hugs and tears, that kind of stuff. We were actually sort of shocked as a band out on the road at how much other bands didn't really seem to like each other's company that much, and we were never like that. And also, the thing that I really missed the most about Soundgarden and Audioslave, really, are the relationships with the guys and being out, you know, with them and the bonding that you have, especially with Soundgarden, because we started from playing small venues with nobody in them. I mean, there are actually moments in this Anvil movie that remind me of the early days of Soundgarden, except for we were in our 20s instead of our 50s. But, you know, showing up at a venue that's been set up by an indie label or an indie promoter and no one's bothered to promote it and there's nobody there and I'm basically, we're playing to the janitor, you know. And going through that with them, from that to where we finally ended up with Down the Upside, that's a lot to go through with people. You know, those are experiences that we all have together that, you know, brought us together and bonded us in a way that's, you know, it's hard to compare to anything else.
If you can put this into words, what was it like in those early days of the quote-unquote grunge movement? I mean, you were there in the epicenter. You were part of the epicenter. Did you have any idea that you were upending rock status quo?
No, not in the beginning. Because the true beginning of it, I think, was actually pre-Nirvana, pre-Pearl Jam, pre-Mother Love Bone, even, really. When the members of, you know, what ended up being Pearl Jam and Mudhoney were in a band called Green River. That was when we sort of aspired to be part of this mostly U.S. post-punk independent scene. That's what we wanted to do. And when Green River put out a record on Homestead, it was like, it was a huge triumph. That was what we wanted to be a part of. And we were huge fans of different labels, and it was a really vibrant scene. And even now, if I listen to that music or YouTube those artists and see those moments, it's pretty damn vital and strong. And that's all. That's what we aspired to be a part of. It wasn't until, I think, Kim Thiel introduced Bruce Pabbitt, who was someone that had a fanzine called Sub Pop.
Sure.
And Jonathan Poneman, who was became a local fixture. He's from Ohio, but he was I think he helped run the local college radio station, and he was in a band himself and the songwriter himself. When Kim introduced those two, Jonathan wanted to sort of invest in the future of Soundgarden because he had some money and he wanted to really, you know, help us release a record. Kim thought, well, that's great, but you don't know anything about the world of indie records. But here's Bruce Pabbitt, and he knows everything about it. So take your money, go over here with the guy that knows what he's doing, and together you guys can put out records and it will be great. And really, that all came from Kim's mind, I think. And it was brilliant because together, Bruce knew everything about everything that was cool and hip, and John was like the best A&R guy you'll ever know.
Right.
And he started showing up with bands and music, and that was the first time he gave me a copy of demos from Nirvana, which ended up being most of it ended up being Bleach. And he kept showing up with stuff like that. And that was when I started to think, okay, this is really not like other places. That how do you keep finding these amazing bands? And these amazing bands with like amazing singers and lyrics and there are real songs. And because at that point, we had already toured around the U.S. and Europe and played shows with a lot of local talent and not seen anything like what Seattle had. Once Sub Pop sort of could give it a name and sort of present it, you know, via a label, is when I think we all could kind of see, oh, this can change everything. This can be something that actually really has a huge impact. Even still, though, it's a kind of a cultural phenomenon that I don't care who you are, nobody could predict it. And a lot of it was MTV driven. I think MTV was camping on rock bands who were sort of larger than life, really good looking people, with like hot sluts in the videos and amazing expensive cars, and doing a little bit of what hip hop does, which is sort of separate the artist from its fans,
right,
kind of. And to some degree, fans like their rock stars to be larger than life.
Sure.
When I met Brian May, I was thrilled that he was taller than me and he had a like floor length overcoat and he looked like a fucking rock star like you're supposed to. I was thrilled. But the first time MTV showed a Nirvana video, for example, here's a song that is better than most of these other hair metal bands. More aggressive, intelligent lyrics, and yet the singer guitar player is like 5'2", the bass player is like 6'8", and the drummer, you know, is this long-haired, creepy-looking guy that looked like their audience.
Sure.
And I think that was where the match struck. It was the audience, and it was a cultural phenomenon, the audience made that choice based on that. And a lot of it was MTV-driven. I think the same thing happened with Soundgarden, same thing happened with Pearl Jam. People saw it on TV, and visually, that helped the leap from what it sounds like to who the people are, and then that made the whole thing really happen.
Plus, everything has to be at the proper time. I mean, when the Beatles came out, they were
time
here at the
huge.
Right time.
Sure,
you know.
Sure.
So it was the right time to flush all that other stuff away, and here is the new wave, so to speak.
Yeah, there's something cyclical about it. There's something, you know. I knew, okay, somehow what we're doing is going to be homogenized and bastardized and turned into what will be then, you know, the commercial rock norm. And I can't imagine how that will happen and what that will be. And then I heard Creed, and I went, oh, that's it. And what's funny is that there's still a lot of rock music that gets played on rock radio stations right now that is very much derivative of that, of a combination of all of the Seattle bands. And there's some other bands you have to include. I think that the Seattle and Sub Pop was a big part of it. There were a lot of other bands that were included in that. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, Faith No More, Jane's Addiction was hugely a part of that shift in thinking. I think Metallica was.
Mm-hmm.
I even think Guns N' Roses was. Guns N' Roses and Metallica, you know, sort of to different audiences kind of helped the public consciousness, not even so much the public, but the publications and television and radio sort of introduced them to the idea that maybe fans would like something a little less pristine and polished and made up, you know, and maybe a little bit more real. Because, like, if you're growing up in a blue-collar existence in the Midwest, there's something about celebrating the larger-than-life look of a hair metal band performance and that sort of god above you that you can worship. But there's also something to relating to the music that you listen to. I think that comes around in cycles.
So last question. How sick are you of this Trent Reznor Twitter business?
Well, it's really, like, I actually never even read whatever it is that he said. So I don't know even what it was, but I think, you know, it's not a surprising thing. To me, it's sort of been, if anything, kind of good because it gets people talking about my record. And I think this album is like, it's huge challenge for me to get people to really listen to and get into and actually, you know, give it a chance and listen to the whole thing. And I know just from personal friends and experience already that there are some people who are going to hate it just based on the concept of it. There are some people who are going to honestly hate it just because they don't like it and they don't like music generated by synths and drum loops, or if they do, they prefer it to be a more aggressive version, whatever. That's fair. To hate it conceptually without giving a chance is silly, but, you know, there's people like that. And there are people who legitimately didn't like it and listened to it, and it's become one of their favorite albums, and they're huge fans of mine. And then there's also people who don't know me from Adam, who
discovered the album because it's musically different and has reached different places who love it. So, you know, it's done all those things. But getting people to talk about it, getting people to be interested in it, if even with negativity, that draws people to it.
Right.
You know, because it gets people talking. And the best thing about it for me, and I really can tell you quite honestly, I'm really happy to be sitting here today talking about music and having an album like this out, as opposed to talking about an album that I think is, you know, this is very similar to something I did a year ago or five
right.
years ago or 10 years ago. To me, you know, this is one of the most vital periods of my career. I don't know if what the best word would be, that controversy, which seems like a silly word, if you want to use that word, you know, the controversy surrounding it, it's not a bad thing. I don't think it'll affect my choices that I make musically. And the exciting thing about it is A, seeing new fans, B, seeing the faces of people when I'm performing the songs live, and they see it sort of actually how it does all kind of fit in with who I am personally. And it's, at the end of the day, I'm not someone that you can easily compare to anybody else in rock music or popular music, period. And in some ways that's a good thing, in some ways it's not a good thing. I've been sort of a restless guy who has a huge record collection and wants to participate in lots of different kinds of music, as opposed to just being an audience member. You know, it's like if I was watching baseball and soccer and football and basketball, and you know, I want to play them too.
Right.
You know, it's that. And you know, I will never forget my fans, which is why I play 3-hour shows and mm-hmm. do my whole catalog. And I will never lose touch with music generated by guitars, or aggressive music generated by guitars, to be honest. I mean, it's always going to be a part of what I'm interested in. But it's always only going to be a part of it.
Well, Chris, thank you very much. The record is called Scream, Chris Cornell's new record. This is Joe Basso for Music Radar, and I've been speaking with Chris Cornell. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.